Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Do you believe in signs from the universe? Do you believe that a heavenly event can portend earthly ones? If the skies lit up and then the earth cracked open and swallowed us, wouldn't you think the sky had been trying to warn us? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I'm not a huge believer in signs from the universe. I think the universe doesn't care much about us one way or the other. Sometimes I do think that natural disasters are Earth's way of trying to shake us off, like fleas on a dog. But plenty of people do believe in signs. What I might call a coincidence or just cool timing, someone else might see as the universe sending them a message. More power to you if that's you. I love all the ways people find to get through this life, especially the ways that don't include being a dick to the people around you. So if it's looking for signs, look away. Listen. Sometimes a hat is just a hat, you know? And sometimes a comet is just a chunk of space debris orbiting close enough to us so that we can see it every so often. But it might not be so crazy to see a comet as a sign of things to come. And for people without the benefit of scientific study and knowledge, it probably wasn't crazy at all. As all horror stories do, this one begins innocuously enough. In fact, it started out rather prosaically. By March of 1811, a bright comet had been seen by almost everyone on Earth. At first, it was too low in the sky for many to spot, but by fall, it had become a blazing presence across the sky, visible on Earth even during the day, shocking in its constancy and, as the world was not yet much limited by light pollution, exceedingly memorable. If you believed in portents, which most everybody in what is now Middle America did in the early 19th century, this was a hell of a warning. The comet itself was only seen every 3,065 years, which meant that it was last visible in the time of Egypt's Ramses II. Before that, it had been overhead when Moses of the Old Testament, per the book of Exodus, led the Israelites out of Egypt and into the wilderness. The comet, now studied by astronomers, is more than a million miles wide and 50 times larger than our sun. Its tail is likely 100 million miles long. Honestly, I can't even begin to wrap my head around numbers like that. The thing is, suffice to say, massive. Back in 1811, no one was naming comets yet, like Halley or Hale-Bopp, so this one was just referred to as C/1811F1. But the last time it had made an appearance, Napoleon Bonaparte saw it as a sign from the heavens that he should invade Russia. Spoiler alert, that did not go well for Napoleon. Back on this continent, it gave some Native Americans a reason to believe that one of their own was a messenger of the Great Spirit. It also created a burning interest in astronomy worldwide. It was said to be responsible for some great literature, as Leo Tolstoy used it to symbolize transformation in War and Peace, which later, of course, inspired the authors of the Tony Award-winning musical Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. It is said to have incited good, raining fortune on some, but it also rained evil. And depending on how much credence you give to such things, it almost certainly rained a kind of manifest tumult that actually made the earth quake. Strangers, I've been telling you this for years now, so it's time for those of you who haven't gotten on board to get on board. Miracle Made sheets are the best. I absolutely love them. First of all, they are so soft, they feel like super luxury sheets. More importantly, though, they are made with silver-infused fabric with technology inspired by NASA that not only helps keep your temperature regulated, but also prevents almost 100% of bacteria growth, which means you do less laundry because your sheets are already doing the work to keep themselves clean. Upgrade your sleep as the weather heats up. Go to trymiracle.com/strange to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo STRANGE at checkout, you'll get a free 3-piece towel set and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/strange and use the code STRANGE to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/strange to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. By the early 1800s, the land in Virginia had been tortured to death by the continuous growing of tobacco. The plant is a notorious nutrient sucker. Whole towns moved west to find better, more fertile land to deplete anew. Granted, farmers didn't know what we know now about crop rotation and the benefits of organic fertilizers or the effects of erosion, but agriculture wasn't exactly a newfangled thing either. Regardless, going west meant going from, say, Virginia next door to Kentucky to start over. Those farmers brought enslaved people with them. And some land in Virginia got a well-deserved rest. It wasn't just the tenant farmers that had to move on. It was also the family of Charles Lilburn Lewis and his wife, Lucy. Lucy, by the way, was the younger sister of then-President Thomas Jefferson. Lucy was also her husband's first cousin, because that's how that whole bunch rolled, I guess. In any case, Jefferson was not close to Lucy after she married. The families, who lived close together and had built genuine friendships and alliances, had grown apart. Charles and Lucy had 8 children, including 2 sons named Lilburn and Randolph, who in 1806 moved off their depleted land with their parents. In 1808, Lilburn and Randolph each acquired land and homes in what is now the tiny burg of Smithland, current population 237, in Livingston County, Kentucky. It's located where the Ohio and Cumberland rivers meet, in the extreme southeast reaches of the Commonwealth. A lot of the Lewis family members followed suit, so that pretty quickly there were 21 Lewises and 24 of those unfortunate souls owned by the Lewises in the Bluegrass State. Lilburn married 27-year-old Elizabeth, who had 5 children and then gave up the ghost in 1809, leaving the increasingly debt-ridden Lilburn, an imbecile, if there ever was one, to care for his children. His father was less than helpful. He preferred to bitch. Per a letter found in the National Archives, Charles wrote Jefferson a rather nasty little addendum to his treatise on how great the fishing was in Kentucky. He wrote, quote, "I think the richness combined with the immense quantity of fertile lands in the western country will be the means of establishing a great deal of indolence. I find herein the blacks and whites are very much so. The labor of the woman to procure clothing is much the hardest labor done. They are the constant employ of both colors. Were I in the same situation as a number of the poor are in Virginia, I should prefer to be a slave in Kentucky than a free man in Virginia. The situation of the slave here is far preferable to the males of every description here, who don't work more than 1/4 of their time." End quote. So a privileged white man writes to the president of the United States about his great hardship. Hey, bruh, it sucks to get a good pair of pants, and the enslaved should be grateful. Anyway, Charles' wife, Lucy, died in 1810. Lucy may not have realized it, but she had good timing, choosing to depart when things were about to get way worse. That's because Randolph, her eldest, was set to inherit most of Charles Lewis' rather frazzled estate. But he died right after his mother in February 1811, and this put Lilburn in the family driver's seat. That meant Lilburn had his own five children, his unmarried sisters, Randolph's family, as well as his unemployed and bitter younger brother Isham, who had shown up in 1809 only to contract malaria to care for as well. All of this was happening while the Lewis family reputation and financial well-being were going down the tubes. Fast. When he'd sufficiently recovered from what some back then called jungle fever, Isham got the hint that he needed to contribute to the family's well-being. To that end, he leaned on his uncle Thomas Jefferson for help in finding work, and Jefferson sent word for him to come learn the art of surveying at Monticello. Isham got himself to Charlottesville for a crash course. Then Uncle Thomas gave him a few names and wrote letters to friends asking them to perhaps employ the lad. It looks as if Isham may have blown off Uncle Thomas as he traveled to Mississippi, but records fail to establish if the young man ever worked as a surveyor there. We do know he retreated back to Kentucky in the fall of 1811. Once back, Isham found his brother Lilburn, a man who had been raised to believe that life was a welcoming breeze, was standing in very strong headwinds. His wife of 12 years died, and he was mired in debt because he was just shitty with money. In 1809, he had only brought in $250, which is just over $6,200 in today money. Well, well below the poverty line. His mother died, then an uncle, and Lilburn was not doing a great job of coping. The addition of his feckless brother could hardly have made things better. The two younger and decidedly ne'er-do-well Lewis sons were already no credit to the Jefferson legacy. They drank, they had no real income, they spent unwisely, they were mean, they bemoaned the cruelty of having lost all their wealth and all that privilege. Sure, their uncle was Thomas Jefferson, their second cousin was Meriwether Lewis, the great explorer of the Louisiana Purchase in the Pacific Northwest. They were once somebodies. They crackled with resentment, and it fairly oozed out of their pores. Isham may have just been bored. All signs suggested that Lilburn was bordering on dangerously unhinged. On December 15th, according to Jay Feldman, author of When the Mississippi Ran Backwards, a 17-year-old enslaved man named George had been sent to fetch water on the property and fell and broke a pitcher. George was not a compliant enough person, in Lilburn's estimation, so he was already in some hot water. George returned to explain his circumstances to the Lewis brothers. They'd been drinking. And Lilburn lost whatever decency and humanity he had left in him. He gathered all of the enslaved people in his care together so they might watch him administer a little discipline to the errant young man. I will dispense with most of the gore. Just know that George was handcuffed and bolted to the floor, while others were forced to watch him being decapitated. You heard that correctly. The young man was beheaded, then chopped up a bit for breaking a pitcher. The Lewis boys then decided to have the enslaved men on hand, some were members of George's family and all were his friends, dispense with the evidence of the killing. They were told, according to author Feldman, quote, to hack up George's body into pieces and throw the pieces into the fire, end quote. The passage in the book continues, quote, it was well past midnight when the slaves finished scrubbing the cabin clean of George's blood and bits of flesh and bone. Before Lilburn and Isham retired, the brothers heaped wood into the fireplace, priming the fire to burn for the rest of the night and consume all evidence of the crime. End quote. Lilburn then said if anyone told, they too would be similarly dispatched. No one doubted his wickedness now. Then, whatever holds the universe together seemingly cracked open. In short order, around 2 a.m., the first of a succession of massive tectonic shifts, the largest sequence ever recorded in the continental United States to date, ripped open the Earth on the New Madrid Fault, less than 75 miles away. On the modern Richter scale, the first rattling would be measured as an 8.0 earthquake. It was followed by a 7.4 aftershock. According to newspaper reports at the time, an anonymous New Madrid, Missouri resident wrote to a friend and said the earth moved, houses shook, and fissures, some 600 to 700 feet in length, opened in the earth, roaring into existence. During the long days of bumping and grinding that followed, Louisville engineer Jared Brooks devised a way to measure the ongoing quakes and their intensity. By employing pendulums and springs, he recorded 1,874 separate shocks between that first rattle and May 15th, when the shaking ostensibly stopped. I say ostensibly because New Madrid residents reported feeling tremors almost daily until 1814. But I am ahead of myself here. One of the very first things that happened that early morning after Lilburn murdered George when the earthquake struck was the complete collapse of the kitchen chimney at the Lewis home in Smithland. The collapse extinguished the white-hot fire in the hearth, which meant that George's bits and pieces were not consumed, and thus, not concealed. The Lewis brothers now had a fresh problem on their hands, one much, much bigger than a non-compliant enslaved person and a broken pitcher. Strangers, I am on the struggle bus these days, and I know a lot of you are too. How can we not be? Well, actually, one way to ease some of the mental load is with delicious CBD gummies from Cornbread Hemp. Whether you're looking to ease your body or your mind, Cornbread Hemp gummies are formulated to help relieve discomfort, stress, and sleeplessness. All their products are third-party lab-tested and USDA organic to ensure safety and purity. If you're looking for a way to ease some of that stress, I highly recommend Cornbread Hemp CBD Gummies. Right now, Strange and Unexplained listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE at checkout. That's cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Across the immediate region, the death of George the Slave, as he would henceforth be referred to in newspapers and histories and Google to come, was the least of anyone's problems. When the first earthquake hit, it would usher in the largest sequence of quakes known in North America, then or since. The Mississippi River's waters convulsed so completely that the boundaries of it changed in an instant. With great lengths of river palisades going into the water, new islands appearing midstream, impromptu damming of large sections, and water rushing temporarily backward to flood small encampments on land. An estimated 50 boats were lost in the rise and fall of its contents. On land, people were thrown out of their beds by the shaking and the noise. Roused in the pitch dark, of course, all the inhabitants of an entire slice of Middle America fled their homes to escape being crushed, only to be greeted by the violent shaking of the earth underneath them. They immediately smelled sulfurous gas, which made many believe that Judgment Day had arrived and Satan was emerging from the bowels of the earth, per Revelations 20, verses 7 and 8. Citing scripture, they believed the devil's brief release from hell to deceive the nations would happen just before God would throw him into a lake of fire. According to a 2001 piece in Illinois Country Living magazine, the rotten egg smell that accompanied the New Madrid quakes was real, caused by what scientists posit was, quote, the release of trapped gas from decomposing organic matter underground, end quote. The noise that many described as deafening was not actually the sound the quake made, according to Southern Illinois University geophysicist Harry Henson, as the noise of grinding tectonic plates is too low a frequency for human perception. Instead, the professor said, the noise was generated by the rapid cracking and shifting of the structures residents were in or near. Giant chasms opened up in the earth where the tectonic plates had forced openings or where the shaking had caused the earth to squeeze so much that it sank whole homes. As geologists would later explain, the latter was the result of liquefaction, a process that happens when areas with aquifers or underwater streams get squeezed and the earth becomes, well, liquid, thus creating sinkholes or mudslides if the land is perched on a hillside. Liquefaction was not uncommon, as the quakes originated very near the Mississippi and Ohio rivers, which were fed by a plethora of springs and creeks in the region. The process was also responsible for a phenomenon in which sand and water shot into the sky. Reports from that first day indicate that residents saw geysers that reached 30 feet into the air. It was worse on the river, where whole chunks of riverbank tumbled into the water, altering its course such that river captains for years had trouble finding familiar landmarks and safe anchorage. The land upheaval created lakes and ponds where they had not previously existed. The best example of that is Tennessee's Real Foot Lake, which was formed during the earthquake swarm, drowning the inhabitants of indigenous villages. During the worst of the quakes, lightning was said to have been unleashed from the earth. This would later be called seismoluminescence, a phenomenon that the United States Geological Survey says is still under debate. That is, some geophysicists think that what looked like lightning coming from inside the earth was actually from the electrical charges given off as rocks break apart during seismic events. Other experts dismiss that idea, pointing out that, at least now, the phenomenon can be partially explained by electricity arcing from the shaking and breaking of power lines. Though back then, of course, there weren't power lines. The effects of this terrifying earthquake had those who experienced it saying tame animals became wild and wild animals became tame. Snakes, it was said, left hibernation. Bears, too. Birds took to the air and stayed there. The rumbling was said to have been felt in New York, Boston, and at the James and Dolly Madison White House. Descriptions of the initial terror would show up in the nation's newspapers in the coming months, like this one on February 17, 1812. Quote, "The effect of these shocks appeared to have been of the most alarming kind. The barge commandeered by the author of this letter was anchored in 2.5 fathoms of water about 17 miles below New Madrid, or 87 miles below the mouth of the Ohio. The vessel was acted upon by the water in a manner that excited a suspicion of her being grounded, but upon sounding, they could find no bottom. The current increased to 3 times the velocity it had the preceding evening. 2 flat-bottom boats that were laying at the shore were destroyed. One was broken entirely to pieces and the other overturned. The crew saved themselves. At the second shock, millions of trees that were embedded in the mud in the bottom of the river suddenly elevated to the surface, rendering the river almost impassable. At the same time, the banks were shook into the river in large masses." End quote. From that first day forward through March of 1812, there were between 6,000 and 10,000 earthquakes in the region. A quake almost as large as the first rattled an already rattled population on January 23rd. Geologists would later say it was a 7.8 on the Richter scale. On February 7th, that was followed by the largest yet, an 8.8. Fun science note for the interested, and I'm going to quote Wikipedia here, quote, "Because of the logarithmic basis of the scale, each whole number increase in magnitude represents a tenfold increase in measured amplitude. In terms of energy, each whole number increase corresponds to an increase of about 31.6 times the amount of energy released. And each increase of 0.2 corresponds to approximately a doubling of the energy released, end quote. So, yeah, an 8.8 must have felt like the rapture, but it wasn't. As a result, large lakes became dry land, open plains became riddled with tortured ravines and open abysses, causing whole neighborhoods to pack up and move on. Most felt that God himself was speaking. A letter writer to the Clarion and Tennessee State Gazette preached that the feared fire and brimstone was now manifest. Quote, "Are these the forerunners of the great earthquake spoken of in Revelations? Judge for yourselves. I only lay before you the phenomena as they are exhibited. The late earthquakes appear as if the surface of the earth was but a shell which covered a sea of subterranean flame that occupied the center and was ready to burst through the pore of the earth universally." End quote. The devout Christian pioneers, though, were not the only ones impressed by God's dismay. This was the same time in American history when the Native Americans had realized that maybe the white man was not going back home and that he had every intention of not sharing what was not his. Born in 1768, a warrior chief named Tecumseh was, by 1811, the leader of the Shawnee Nation, a Native American people who likely originated along the Central Ohio River Valley. Think Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia. Because of alliances and conflicts, the Shawnee Nation had spread west into the Mississippi River Valley. Tecumseh's name, rather beautifully and coincidentally apt given the appearance of the comet, can be translated to mean shooting star or he who walks across the sky. In 1809, in something called the Treaty of Fort Wayne, an agreement was reached that required Indian bands to sell 3 million acres of land to the United States government. For the record, Tecumseh was not willing to make treaties and keep moving west when the Europeans who had come a few generations earlier seemed intent on expanding into native lands and claiming them as their own. He made it his mission to rally the various tribal units to stop the sale and the ongoing takeover. He even went so far as to suggest that the Native Americans owned that land, if anyone did, even though before the colonizers came, the idea of owning earth was largely preposterous. Sure, you and your people might have claim to a certain area, but that didn't mean you owned the very earth underneath it.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
In Tecumseh's effort to stop other bands from making deals and continually packing their bags and moving on, he was aided by his brother, Tenskwatawa. His brother agreed that indigenous people had strayed from their roots. His message was more a spiritual plea, urging all native people to return to their traditional values. He advised a life that eschewed acceptance of the encroachers' ways, their food, their clothing, their beliefs, and their alcohol. This came after he had found himself slipping into a life of alcohol and general tomfoolery when he was a teenager, until one day he awoke from a drunken stupor to proclaim that the Great Spirit had spoken to him and advised a new path. His given name was Lalawitika, which meant noisemaker. When he joined his brother's cause to tamp down the onslaught of the white man into their territory, he changed his ways and gave himself a new name to go with those changed ways. His new name, Tenskwatawa, meant open door or one with an open mouth. which one could argue was a more positive and productive way of saying noisemaker. Tenskwatawa was still going to be a noisemaker, but now the noise was going to be in the service of leading his people. Soon, Tenskwatawa became known as the Shawnee Prophet. He gained much acclaim for predicting the solar eclipse that occurred on June 16, 1806. According to Kent State University history professor James Seeley, the Shawnee were not known to be sky watchers, but other bands were. It is likely, said Seeley, writing in Kent State Today, that Tenskwatawa heard of the coming eclipse from them. And they may have been told of the impending celestial event by the white man. It was forecast in almanacs that circulated widely at the time. It could be, I suppose, but it also could be that indigenous peoples had been tracking the skies for thousands of years and could accurately predict the same things the white man's almanac could. Either way, Tecumseh told his people his brother predicted an eclipse and then publicly ordered the Great Spirit to release the sun, which, it seems, the Great Spirit did. Both acts impressed their followers greatly. Together, the twosome was well on their way to changing history. They established Prophetstown in what is now just north of Lafayette, Indiana, with Tenskwatawa holding down the fort, so to speak, while Tecumseh went out to recruit more bands in his quest to halt European progress. Tecumseh could not understand why it was so hard to impress upon his native brethren that they were in a fight for their very lives. It's hard for some people to be forward-thinking enough to realize that their very survival is threatened. It's kind of how we ended up in the predicament we're in now as a species. For decades, a small group of people with proper foresight and common sense have been going, hey, we have to stop raping the land or we're going to be in trouble. While the larger group was willingly sticking their heads in the sand and going, nah, we'll be fine. And now, here we are. That kind of obstinacy enraged Tecumseh. And this is where that comet I introduced way back at the beginning of this episode comes into play. While trying to convince certain Creek Nation leaders in Tuckabatchee, Alabama, of the wisdom of becoming allies, Tecumseh told them the comet was proof of the Great Spirit's wrath at their obstinacy. While there, it was October when he spoke to the Creeks, the comet grew daily even brighter in the sky. If a burning ball of fire that seemed to be getting closer wasn't a sign of the Great Spirit's wrath, what was? Openly frustrated by their indifference and lack of urgency in responding to his pretty smart little plan of joining forces and standing their ground, Tecumseh was reported to have lashed out at one chief in particular, telling him, "Your blood is white," which is a pretty serious fuck you, I'm guessing. According to Susan Elizabeth Howe and Roger G. Billum, writing in the Oxford Academic in 2005, Tecumseh continued to rail, quote, "You do not believe the Great Spirit has sent me. You shall know. I leave Tuckabatchee directly and shall go straight to Detroit. When I arrive there, I will stamp on the ground with my foot and shake down every house in Tuckabatchee," end quote. Listen, was claiming to be a messenger of God the most honest method of convincing? No. Was it unique? Absolutely not. Tecumseh joins a great list of people throughout history who have claimed to have been sent by God just to get people to do what they wanted. Howe and Billum continued, quote, "The Creeks counted the days until the one calculated to mark Tecumseh's return, and on that day, December 16, 1811, the first of the great New Madrid earthquakes struck, destroying all the houses in Tuckabatchee," end quote. On December 16th, Tecumseh was not in Detroit. He'd detoured, apparently, to visit the Shawnee and Delaware Indian villages near Cape Girardeau, Missouri, some 50 miles north of the first quake's epicenter. But the Creeks didn't know that. He said he'd leave them, go to Detroit, and the earth would shake. He left them, and a short while later, the earth shook. Alan W. Eckert, author of A Sorrow in Our Hearts, The Life of Tecumseh, wrote, quote, "The significant fact is not whether Tecumseh did or did not predict the earthquakes, but that the Creeks believed he had done so. That belief was crucial, for it established Tecumseh's credibility," end quote. He looked like a fucking wizard. For many years to come, the comet would be called Tecumseh's Comet because of the brief moment in American history when it appeared, at least at the time, that Native resistance and British alliance could slow the loss of indigenous lands. At that point, the British were like, oh, yeah, we're totally on your side. Yeah, if you help us beat back this revolution, we will totally let you have whatever land you want. LOL. The Creeks, now afraid of Tecumseh's wrath, took up their rifles and were ready to follow him into war. But whatever spirit was in charge had chosen 6 weeks prior to lay down a different scenario. Unbeknownst to both Tecumseh and the Creeks, when the Shawnee warrior was away from home, Governor William Henry Harrison of the Indiana Territory decided to march against Prophetstown. Harrison, he later became the 9th president of the United States, was set to meet privately with Tenskwatawa during a temporary ceasefire. Tenskwatawa preempted the meeting, though, and early on the morning of the meeting on November 7, 1811, Tenskwatawa attacked Harrison's camp. But Harrison was ready. The ensuing violence became known as the Battle of Tippecanoe. Historian James Pennock Jr. wrote in the December 1975 issue of American Heritage magazine, quote, "The Battle of Tippecanoe in November was a standoff with enormous losses on both sides, but the slain Indian warriors were irreplaceable." Tecumseh continued his travels unaware that his military power was already broken. Harrison claimed victory, but ignorance of the whereabouts of Tecumseh and the battle's inconclusive character left the border jittery. These events mingled strangely with the earthquake, end quote. The Shawnee had lost many men and saw their village burned and food supply destroyed. Fun fact, a common method of genocide is attacking and controlling the food supply. Not knowing anything of what was happening in Prophetstown, Tecumseh frightened and angered the white settlers mostly just for trying to rouse his people to stand up against them, telling other tribes that, quote, "The Great Spirit is angry with our enemies. He speaks in thunder, and the earth swallows up villages and drinks up the Mississippi. The great waters will cover their lowlands, their corn cannot grow, and the Great Spirit will sweep those who escape to the hills from the earth with his terrible breath," end quote. While Tecumseh took credit for divine intervention, white settlers became concerned. Pioneer church attendance rose 50% in the region. They, too, of course, believed their God was responsible for the awful things happening around them. If they could just appease him, maybe everything would go back to normal? Or they'd be raptured? I don't know how it works. In turn, the indigenous peoples joined the British when push came to shove, and the U.S. launched a war which later became known as the War of 1812. The earthquakes, the Great Prediction, and the glory of Prophetstown were, by then, ancient history. Tecumseh was killed on October 5, 1813, in the Battle of the Thames in southern Canada. And because this was a time when brutality was largely expected, he was stripped and scalped. His skin was peeled for souvenirs.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
I know that must have seemed like a rather large aside when I was just getting rolling on the murder of George over the broken pitcher. It wasn't. It was just me figuring you needed to know that this was a wackadoodle time in the flyover states, and all kinds of people were living and dying, with the earthquakes providing a rather colorful daily experience to endure. Now I want to return to the smaller scale but equally earth-shattering horrors being visited on those who lived and toiled on the Lewis land. You should know that Lilburn had remarried just a year before, and his new wife, Letitia, was 8 months pregnant. She did not witness the atrocity in the kitchen, but heard the enslaved members of her household as they shrieked in horror while it was occurring. She knew what had happened. So did her parents, who lived within the Lewis household. Then, of course, the first quake distracted everyone as furniture flew, walls fell, and people ran for their lives. The rather impressive aftershocks continued, but sometime that next day, when the Lewis brothers sobered up and reassessed, they saw that evidence of George's murder had been laid bare in the rubble. They promptly ordered their genuinely terrorized enslaved people to rebuild the chimney post-haste, instructing them to incorporate the various parts of their friend George into the masonry walls. Christ Almighty. I'm guessing that Lilburn and Isham thought they were pretty fucking on top of things. They weren't. They had not counted on the continuing earthquake swarm, which on February 7th brought the chimney down for a second time. And the Lewis dog, a trusty pup named Nero, took off with George's skull, and the big secret wasn't so secret anymore. Some shit just can't stay hidden, nor should it. As Feldman explains in When the Mississippi Ran Backwards, quote, "In the colonial era, the punishment for killing a slave was simply a fine. By 1812, however, most slave states had laws equating the murder of slaves with the homicide of whites, unless the slave happened to die in the course of moderate correction or was slain while resisting the administration of punishment," end quote. Wow. Not much has changed? George's unprovoked slaughter fit neither of those exemptions. And Lilburn Lewis, despite his efforts to hide his crime, probably still felt mighty certain that no one in authority gave a rat's ass about what he'd done, especially since it was still not legal for blacks to testify against whites. Who exactly was going to point the finger? But the skull had been found, and Lilburn had not reported, as was required, that one of those humans he purportedly owned had died a premature death, even accidentally. It looked bad, though it isn't surprising that Lilburn was convinced he had nothing to worry about. But word traveled fast in certain circles, and people not in those circles still heard the murmurs, and Lilburn, most unexpectedly, was charged with murder. Not manslaughter, murder. If found guilty, he would hang. And so would Isham, who had been added to the list of those responsible for George's death. What had caused law enforcement to care? Feldman writes that Letitia, Lilburn's new wife, who was legally prohibited from testifying against her husband, had agreed to do so against Isham. Letitia's parents, who now feared for their daughter's safety, had agreed to testify against their son-in-law. Meanwhile, the earth was still rocking and rolling, shuddering and shaking, moving the very ground under everyone's feet. Even for the sane, it was crazy-making. Bond was set for both brothers, who decided that they'd take matters into their own hands. On April 10, 1812, they walked to a family burial plot to, I don't know, save people time? In the oddness of the moment, Isham asked Lilburn to show him how to use a stick to pull the trigger on his flintlock rifle, and in the demonstration, Lilburn shot himself through the heart. Or that was Isham's story, anyway. Who knows? Isham fled, only to be found and put in the county lockup, from which he escaped a few weeks later. This time, he really was gone. He'd somehow managed to enlist in the army, possibly under an assumed name, and was killed in action at the Battle of New Orleans on the very last day of 1814. He was buried on the battlefield. Isham's death, while no tragedy in my book, was, like all those who died in the Battle of New Orleans, unnecessary. That's because it happened a week after the Treaty of Ghent, the treaty that officially ended the war between the United States and Great Britain, had been signed. News had not yet reached the battlefield, and the battle, of course, had no bearing on its end. Surprisingly and noteworthy, the very first steam-powered riverboat, the New Orleans, was on its maiden voyage on the Mississippi on the day of the first quake. It had stopped in Louisville a few days before so that the captain's wife could give birth to a son. The night before, the boat had anchored near Owensboro, Kentucky, about 200 miles east of New Madrid. The captain's dog, who usually slept on deck, refused to that night, placing himself in the family cabin with the laboring woman. He knew, because dogs are the best. Anyway, the boat survived the earthquakes, making it to New Orleans by the end of the month, having to dodge massive amounts of debris, its passengers witnessing the devastation on land. Though short on rations, the captain refused to dock for fear the boat would be overrun by survivors. It was a shocking and very real testament to the safety of the nascent steamboat and ushered in a lively age of travel from points north and east to points south, not to mention all that Mark Twain. The once every 3,000-year comet had preceded the American quakes, but also had served to change the destiny of Europe, big and small. The spectacle in the sky sparked much scientific interest in astronomy during its appearance and long, long after. It is given responsibility for the growth of grapes that made what the French would consider one of the greatest vintages ever produced. In fact, those wines produced from those grapes in 1811 began a long-held belief among winemakers that the best vintages, from the years between 1811 to 1989, are the result of notable appearances of comets. Scientists have no idea why. Interest in geological phenomena sparked as well, but only began to be explained in 1850 when, according to André Filiatreault's Elements of Earthquake and Structural Dynamics, Robert Mallet discovered that most earthquake damage was the result of sudden land movement or seismic waves. It wasn't until 1872 that Grove Gilbert figured out that such movements centered around fault lines. Until then, the guesswork persisted. Just after the 1811 to 1812 outbreaks in mid-America, the Daily National Intelligencer and Washington Express opined in its August 5, 1819 edition that the comet was to blame because, quote, earthquakes are caused by a sudden transit of electricity from one stratum of the earth to another or from the earth to the atmosphere, and we can easily imagine that the equilibrium of electricity may be disturbed by the slightest attraction of a comet. If, as some conjecture, a comet's tail consists of electricity, and if its electricity be positive and the earth be charged with negatives, the attraction between them may sometimes be felt. Thus may comets produce earthquakes. End quote. Yeah, well, actually, no. Scientists have been a little more enlightened since then. They no longer even attribute the quakes of 1811 and 1812 as coming from a common fault, but from stress in three fault lines, one in the Missouri Boot Heel and western Kentucky, another in the Wabash Valley, and the third in something called the Commerce Lineament in southern Illinois. The thing about earthquakes is that the warning systems for them are still not terribly refined. The New Madrid region still gets two or three tiny imperceptible quakes a week. But that's known only because the National Geological Survey had hundreds of sensors in the ground to feel them. The danger is worse than ever there, what with so much development on the river and so much infrastructure to fail. Some of the worst danger from quakes comes when gas lines burst, ignite, and burn, while the water mains also burst, spewing forth the water needed to put out the fires from the gas lines. This means that controlling the blazes becomes almost impossible. As for Tecumseh's ability to predict the quakes, there is no scientific basis for that, but that doesn't mean he didn't know. A renowned English geologist, Sir Charles Lyell, once said that the Native Americans in the region all had known something big was coming. Lyell said that because of their closeness to nature and the ways of the earth, they had seen signs. Maybe, But to us, less in tune, earthquakes are unpredictable, as is brutality. As I said, the Earth eventually calmed itself down, with the last official rumble of that sequence taking place on November 9, 1812, a mild 4.0 centered in New Madrid. Not terribly far away, a very young Abraham Lincoln was growing up in Hodgenville, Kentucky. He would have felt the Earth move. He would move it himself a half century later. Oddly enough, just around the time another comet, named Comet 1, was streaking through our skies. Next time on Strange and Unexplained. You've heard of Sleeping Beauty and Rip Van Winkle, but chances are you've never heard of the refugee children who fall into coma-like sleep for months and months on end. The horror that is resignation syndrome. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was researched and written by Amy Wilson and me, Daisy Egan. Sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.